This is the Modest Million Show, episode 12. Price is what you pay, value is what you get. Hey, and welcome back to the Modest Million Show. The show dedicated to helping average folks like you and me better understand and simplify our personal and household finances so we can chart our own path toward modest millions. I'm your host, personal finance enthusiast, dedicated budgeteer, and aspiring modest millionaire, Phil. On today's episode, we talk about the difference between value and price as it relates to your personal finances. For those of you following along, you know I have a reputation as a cheapskate. I say no to spending more often than I say yes. Just ask my wife. I'm known to be a stickler when it comes to things around the budget, which means that discretionary spending gets extra scrutiny. When you've got a budget laid out and you're looking to add new items in, the bottom dollar is what often gets the focus. It makes sense, right? If you have $5,000 coming in and $4,900 budgeted for savings and spending every month, it's easy to see where a $100 per month purchase might slide into the budget. But if you've got your budget locked down and every dollar has a job, as it should, it can be hard to look past the bottom line when making purchasing decisions, whether it's a new monthly cost or a one-time purchase. Going a bit further, when you've determined that you're going to make that plunge and make that extra purchase, do you go with the cheapest option so that it fits neater into your budget, or do you go and make a bigger investment with a more expensive purchase that might last a little bit longer? A couple years ago, I heard a quote that Warren Buffett popularized that has really stuck with me and helped us evaluate some of our purchase decisions over the past few years. He said something along the lines of, "Price is what you pay, value is what you get." Think about that for a minute. It's more than just the price you pay for something. When you focus on the value, you can start breaking down your purchase or your investment into looking at the longer term. Does it mean that you should just ignore the cheapest option? No, definitely not, but also maybe. There's a lot that goes into this. There's another quote that I wanted to attribute to Warren Buffett, but when I was searching the interwebs for the quote, I couldn't find it. If you have some insights here and you know who said this, or if it was Warren Buffett, or you can, you know, point me to the right direction, please reach out and let me know. I'd love to properly attribute this quote wherever it needs to go. But I think he said that he makes purchase decisions based on his estimated cost per use when evaluating, indicating that he's making those decisions based on value. So let's look at some examples. Are you better off paying an annual subscription of $15 a month for a monthly magazine? Or are you better off paying $100 a year for a daily newspaper? If you would read both religiously, front to back, the magazine is only 15% of the cost of the newspaper. So if you're going with the cheapest option, that makes sense. But when you break it down on a cost per use basis, the magazine comes out to $1.25 per issue versus the newspaper, which seems like a steal all of a sudden at 27 cents per issue. Now, let's say you read the magazine front to back twice every issue. Well, then your cost per use slides from $1.25 down to, call it, 62.5 cents per issue, which is still more expensive than the newspaper. Now, there's something else to consider here, and that's whether you need to pay for either of those items rather than just getting your news, your information, your entertainment from the internet and obviously high-quality podcasts, right? But I digress. That's a conversation for a different topic. Just because something is less on a cost per use doesn't necessarily mean that it justifies you buying that item. So how about another example that gets a little stickier? A $500 winter jacket or a $20 t-shirt? Not exactly apples to apples, but but let's go through this process in general because I think it also helps. If you wear the jacket for 125 days every year and the jacket lasts for 5 years, but you only wear the t-shirt 10 times over the course of the t-shirt, doesn't really matter time-wise, It costs you 80 cents each time you wear the jacket and $2 each time you wear the t-shirt. So then you still have to figure out, what do you need more? Do you need a winter jacket or do you need a t-shirt? Well, you technically need both. But what happens then if you go with a cheaper t-shirt or a cheaper jacket? And so then you have to figure out, and that's where it gets to be hard when you go apples to oranges. So let's modify that last example and do more of an apples to apples comparison. What about a $500 winter jacket that has a removable fleece liner that can double as a light jacket that you can wear it in the spring and summer as well, or spring and fall, and that will last you 5 years? Or you can go and just buy a straight up winter jacket, a heavy winter jacket for $75. Now, it probably isn't as, or I shouldn't say probably, but let's assume that it is not the same quality as the $500 winter jacket. So let's say instead of lasting 5 years, it only lasts 2 years. So because the more expensive, and in this case, the better constructed jacket, is more versatile and will last longer due to its higher quality, you're going to be able to wear it for 125 days each year versus the straight-up heavy winter jacket for $75, which you might only be able to wear for 60 days out of the year. So this would imply that you'd need an additional lightweight jacket for the spring and fall if you went with the less expensive jacket, but let's ignore that for right now. So just looking at those two jackets on a cost-per-use basis, the more expensive jacket costs 80 cents per use, and the less expensive jacket costs 63 cents per use. So in this case, the less expensive jacket costs less per use, but since you might still need to buy a lightweight jacket for the non-winter months, you might not come out so far ahead. But for me, if I was making this decision, I would probably feel more optimistic that I'd be able to both make the jacket, the less expensive jacket, last longer, and also that I would be able to wear that heavy winter jacket on some of the warmer days to further maximize my cost per use. So then I'm able to wear it for more than just 60 days out of the year. Now there's another factor to consider too, that it makes it hard to plan. We live in Minnesota where it is normally very, very cold during the winter. However, the past few years have been somewhat mild. And so the really, really cold days are are fewer and far between. You know, there's not 60 super, super cold days. So then a lighter jacket still can make sense. So at that point, then the math gets a little bit stickier and harder to figure out. So it's not always black and white. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt. All right. So this is fun. If you can't tell, I like doing this, breaking things down and running numbers. So let's do another one. This time, let's evaluate whether it makes sense to spend the extra money for a 4-bedroom house versus a 3-bedroom house, just so that you have an extra bedroom and bathroom for guests. For easy math's sake, let's say that all things being equal, including the price per square foot of both houses, the extra 12 by 12 bedroom and the 6 by 9 bathroom would cost an additional $20,000 on top of what the normal price would be for that 3-bedroom house. We'll ignore any costs of heating or cooling or cleaning or otherwise maintaining these additional rooms, or the extra interest we'd pay on the mortgage and carrying costs for that extra $20,000, which would, in all situations, add to that. So it's more than just $20,000. But on the other side, we'll also ignore any resale considerations for now, where you might be able to, you know, better recoup those $20,000. That just complicates the math, so we want to keep it simple for right now. But let's assume that you plan on living in the house for 15 years, and you figure that you might have house guests for 14 nights per year. So maybe they come over between Christmas and New Year's. Maybe you have a couple visiting relatives for a long weekend or two, and that adds up to those 14 nights. So that bedroom is in use 14 nights out of the year. Now, I'm not talking about the closets being in use because you didn't have enough storage in the rest of the house. That doesn't count. So nights that bedroom is being slept in, it would be 210 nights. So that comes out, if you did the math, 210 nights out of $20,000 comes out to $95 per night. So you can probably see where I'm going with this. Would we perhaps be better off putting up our guests in a hotel room while they're in town? Where we live, $95 a night would be pretty comparable for a decent hotel room. Maybe a 3-star room. We don't have a lot of really nice hotels in our neck of the woods, but that's okay. But it's not a Super 8 or something like that too. So it is something to consider. Now, obviously, maybe they would pay for that, but if, let's just say in this case, we did do those, that would be about level. So at that point, then the decision of whether or not we would need that extra bedroom might just come down to personal preference. For me, again, I usually skew on the less expensive side when all things are being equal. I'd rather save the cash flow rather than put that out and not have that money to be able to redirect into other areas. But that's just me. You might feel like you really want that extra space or for them to spread out, so that's okay. So when I thought about some of these assumptions, I had to pause for a second when running those numbers. Right now, we have an extra bedroom when we built this house that will eventually be for our oldest, as our oldest two kids are sharing a room right now. But over almost the past 2 years or so that we've been in this house, I think that guest bedroom has been slept in twice. I can count it on one hand for sure in the number of nights that bedroom has been used. So we are definitely not getting a good cost per use out of that room. And dang it, that makes me kind of mad. Because the reason that it is that both of our families live within a 20-minute drive of our house, so they're not really going to be spending the night at our place. Our parents aren't, and our siblings live either nearby or when they do come home to spend the night, they end up staying at our parents' house. So we'll use the bedroom eventually when our daughter gets a little bit older and is comfortable sleeping in the basement by herself, but we might have been better off putting those dollars to use elsewhere. And that is hard for me to admit and talk about, because I wish that we would have made that decision and run this cost per use scenario earlier when we were designing the house. The same thing can be said for our extra office and some of the other space that we used. But on that same note, we also made a conscious decision not to add in a formal dining room and a formal living room upstairs. We went with a smaller living room because we don't use that space as much as we do our bigger family room down in the basement. So we did make some of those decisions rather than, well, this is just how people design houses now. We're like, well, we don't really use that formal dining room or that formal living room, so it's just empty space that doesn't get used. So let's redirect the cost per that square foot and redirect it somewhere else. All right, let's take a really quick break and then come back to talk about a recent value versus price discussion that we had around our lawn. Budget, budget, budget. When we talk budget on this show, which, hint, it's a lot, it's tough to ignore my favorite budgeting tool, and that is personal capital. There are a handful of other budgeting tools and personal finance tools that are in our quiver, but this is probably one of the arrows that I love going back to more and more. You can track all of your spending and your investments and get a super quick dashboard view of your personal finances. I don't like to spend a whole lot of time going into some of those numbers because we take a more of a passive approach when it comes to our investing, which we'll talk about in future episodes, but it is helpful just to kind of take a peek at and say, okay, all right, that's good. Our balances are still in decent shape. They're still growing overall. And so we can get a really good 30,000 foot view at all of our accounts. And then we can also, if we do want to, we can dive deeper into each of those options. So I love it, and I think you will too. So to grab your free account and start tracking your budget today, go ahead and visit modestmillions.com/capital. All right, and we're back. So we went through a similar sort of cost per use exercise this past spring, and it's absolutely applicable to today's episode. So thanks for indulging me here while I share and talk about this, because I feel pretty good about the decision that we ultimately made. And you maybe have found yourself in a similar sort of dilemma. So we live on about 2.25 acres right now, our own little slice of country, and about half of that is mowable lawn, so lawn that can be mowed, that we worry about landscaping and making look nice. So when we moved into the house, we moved in with a pretty reliable Craftsman self-propelled push lawnmower. And because I geek out over a really manicured lawn, I beg the clippings every time. So that meant we got a really good lawn mow. You could see some really nice lawnmower lines. My wife always gives me a hard time about this, but I love it. And to keep the lawn nice, I fertilize it and water it religiously. So the lawn is really nice and full, which is great when you look at it, but it can make it a really big chore to then mow. So with that push lawnmower, it would take no less than 4 hours every week that I mowed. And I would be mowing once a week, so that was 4 hours per lawn mowing, not, you know, two lawn mowings at 2 hours each. So that was a super tedious task, and it would take up half my Saturday. And this spring, we began looking at riding lawnmowers just to see how much those would cost. We've never owned a riding lawnmower before. Our relatives have, and they swear by them, but we were always just, you know, we just went with the less expensive option of having a push lawnmower. And because we hadn't necessarily budgeted for a riding lawnmower this year, when we were setting aside and identifying our big ticket purchase budget for the year, we were staring down the barrel of a pretty big ticket purchase, especially once we narrowed it down to a couple potential mowers. So for assumption's sake, we figured that we might have to mow the lawn when we started going down this cost per use scenario and these calculations. We figured we might have to mow the lawn about 30 times this year, or every year. And a riding lawnmower, we were considering a zero-turn mower because we have a ton of trees in our yard, and a zero-turn mower versus a riding tractor, so my research told me, would probably let us mow the lawn in about an hour or less each time, including bagging the clippings. So that was pretty substantial as we looked at that. So as we saw it, we had three options moving forward that we needed to calculate. Number one is old reliable, and we would keep using the push mower and pay nothing for a new mower, which essentially meant that the cost per use was effectively zero, but it would take 4 hours to mow the lawn each week. The mower is in good shape and probably will last another 5 years, so you know it would do the trick for a while. Option two was bright and mostly shiny. And so with that one, we would buy a used but virtually new riding lawnmower that came with several extra attachments and had a great full-size engine that was about $3,000. So this mower was pretty much new, and I wouldn't be surprised if that mower ran for about 10 years just with standard maintenance, with the 30 hours that we would put on it each week. So, and then the third option is kind of in the middle, and that one we'll call it tried but true. So if we split the difference and we were giving a really hard look to a 20-year-old riding lawnmower, but it was still pretty relatively well maintained, and the price on it was only $950. Now the reason I say only $950 is that on these riding lawnmowers, if you buy a bagging system, you know, where it has the bags on the back and shoots it up to the side, those alone cost like $500 to $600 new. So when we saw something for $950 that had a bagger already with it, and it ran, and ran relatively reliable, at least when we were looking at it, we gave it a pretty hard look. So there were a lot of factors to consider here, but first was whether or not it was worth the investment to buy a riding lawnmower in the first place, at least this year. The second decision, if we did decide to buy a mower, was whether or not we went with the newer model or the older one. The first part of the decision came down to time saved. Coming from experience working as a commission salesperson, jobs working in marketing agencies, and then also having experience being a consultant, I had several run-ins with the concept that time is money. And it's something I subscribe to, and I hope you do too, because your time is worth something. You might be salaried at work, and you might not have done any sort of consulting, or you might not do any consulting. But anything that's consuming your time at home is taking you away from other things that you could be doing. It could be taking you away from spending time with your kids, or I guess picking lint out of your belly button, or it could be taken away from you working on your side hustle or other billable time if you did decide to do something else and bill your time and put a dollar number on your time. So it is important to be mindful of what your time is worth. So I've got a trick for you. If you want to roughly figure out what your quote-unquote hourly rate is at your salary job, take your salary, move the decimal point three places to the left, and then divide by two. So if you earn $50,000, your hourly rate is $25. Because we removed the three zeros at the end, so then it was just left with 50, then we divided by two, and that landed to $25 an hour. A $70,000 salary equals $35 an hour, roughly. And a $100,000 salary boils down to about $50 an hour. So you get the idea when you're looking at that. So you can do some really quick back-of-the-napkin math. Actually, you might even be able to do that in your head. I hope so. So if your time is worth $50 an hour, let's say, you can do the math as to what you would, quote-unquote, earn by saving that time. So let's just take $35 an hour for an example, because you can see as we get through here, anything higher than that is even more considerable savings. So let's just say $35 an hour is what my time is worth. If I shaved my mowing time from 4 hours down to 1 hour, I'd save 3 hours each mow that I could then redirect into more meaningful uses of my time, which then equals $105 per mow. $35 times 3 equals $105. Multiply that by 30 lawn mowings per year, and that is $3,150 in earned, quote-unquote, earned income over the earned savings over the course of 1 year. And hey, it just so happens that that means that the more expensive mower that we're considering at $3,000 would virtually pay for itself in time saved in just the first year. Add in the fact that the riding lawnmower would last for more than 1 year, and that savings just compounds significantly. Now, obviously, there is the fact of the matter remains that this does not mean that you are billing out that time and you're not earning that money, so it's not technically paying for itself. So keep that in mind, but it could if you needed it to. Okay, so that helped make that decision easier. We're then a go for getting a riding lawnmower. Now we just had to figure out which one was worth stretching the budget for. And this is where we can look at cost per use in an apples-to-apples comparison. The Cadillac version, the nicer version, was $3,000, and that would cost us $10 per use over its 10-year lifespan. The Pinto version, or the old beat-up one that was 20 years old, would be about being listed at $950, and that would cost $10.55 per use over its 3-year lifespan. So that's a difference of the older mower would be 55 cents more per use over that 3-year lifespan. So they come out to about equal. I mean, we're talking about pennies here. So granted, there are a lot of variables. Either lawnmower could live past its projected lifespan, or it could, die out early. So there's really no way to tell when it comes to that. Both were very reliable lawnmower brands, and both were in relatively decent shape compared to their current life. But in this case, since we hadn't necessarily budgeted for the riding lawnmower in the first place, we opted to go with the rusty, older, and far less sexy option for now. So we went with the cheaper option. Because it was, again, all things being equal, we opted for the less expensive option. Then, in 3 years, or hopefully longer, when that blue Dixon lawnmower dies, we can then revisit it and make sure that a zero-turn mower is, in fact, the right decision for us. And then we can invest in a more expensive machine. Or not, or we could just decide that we like kind of going this route and seeing where it goes. So the icing on the cake with this particular, blue Dixon lawnmower was that we ended up negotiating the price of the mower down to $850, or rather than $950, which dropped the cost per use down to $9.44. So big bonus, made the cost per use even less. It's all relative when you're trying to make these decisions, but when you start breaking things down, you can make more rational and objective decisions, which should then help you make more informed decisions later on. All you have to do is remember, that price is what you pay and value is what you get. So that'll do it for this week's episode. I hope this all helped and you found it helpful. I'd love to know if how you make decisions like this when you do have to make a purchasing decision. Do you use the cost per use decisioning, or do you have another method or technique that you use? I'd love to know and what your experience has been and how that's gone for you. So also make sure you reach out with feedback for me or for the show. Maybe their topic ideas, personal anecdotes of your own journey, or if you just want to say hi. And you can always reach me at feedback@modestmillions.com. For a recap of the strategies, tools, and links we talked about today, make sure you check out the show notes at modestmillions.com/012. Also, while you're on the site, don't forget to subscribe so you can get email updates when we do post new episodes. You can do that at modestmillions.com/subscribe. And if you like what we're doing here and you find the information valuable, really would help you or really would appreciate if you help us spread the word and show your support by leaving an honest review, honest and open review, whether it's positive or negative. I just want to hear from you of the show on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on. It makes it super easy if you're listening to us on iTunes podcast, or if you're listening to us from the Google Play Store, or any of those other options that we're on too. I'd love to hear your feedback if you just drop that review. Join me next week when we talk about the power of small dollars when it comes to personal finance. Until then, remember to keep squirreling away now to earn millions later. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.